congratulations again. I don't know if the two guest callers are still with us or not, but if they are, this is called A Tour de Farce. The French protest when English words invade their precious tongue, forgetting all the double entendre their own parlance has sprung. When someone goes out on the piste, we share a crafty wink, and yet he's skiing in Saint Moritz, not knocking back the drink. It's hard to count the words in French that are in daily use. Might I offer you a soupçon without being too obtuse? The posh neighbours from across the way are somewhat nouveau riche. They've got an antique bidet and constantly eat piche. They dine in the best restaurants where French is de rigueur. And when they need to be très chic, they opt for haute couture. When the father wrote his memoirs, avoiding too much gloom, he wanted to disguise himself and chose a nom de plume. The girls are brought up with finesse. The boys are reading Proust. Their constant aim in writing is to look for le mot juste. The trouble is that Anglophones accepted laissez-faire, and to master those French letters had sent their kids au pair.
So then you were still out. How was the French?
It was absolutely perfect.
Was it? Thank you, Mary. And Mary. Next up to the mic, we have Fiona Reardon.
This is called On the Bus. Up at the front of the bus, people chat to the driver, a woman and a man, and between sliding open the accordion doors, watching for the next stop, he talks about his daughter, who is just two, and how they're expecting another. He says how they would like to have three or four, if they can afford it. So life is hanging in the balance of a recession, children existing within the confines of conversation, called out of the cold, stilled air instead of walking on its way to town. The woman listening tells them she herself and a family of five would have liked her own to have had the same, more siblings to rely on. The taunt digests itself, the comfortable silence, one found between strangers, unobliged by conversation. All those children she never ended up having have ended up here. In words beside words about those still with the potential to exist. And the river runs a chin strip left of the road, underbelly of these kiss the surface soft at fingertips, seems have to be kept simple if only the trust is so complicated. Thanks.
Thank you, Fiona. Next up we have, and we don't see her very often, Virginia Regan.
This one's called Asylum Thought. He has come from a faraway land and has come through hell to get here. I can tell by the way he holds himself. He's a very good man. They come for refuge. They come to survive. They come without papers. They get here blind. The system they face is cold, official. The same questions over and over, repeatedly, repeated. 7 hours of interrogation, not much taught for integration. How can you express the distress, the soul-crushing trauma to a system that cannot listen with compassion, when the eyes deal with suspicion and threatens deportation? They come here from fear. They get here frightened. They've lost the lives they knew. We put them in compounds all mixed up together, united in torment. It's no real home. Information they need comes slow, not always from a clear source. The false protection of paranoid projection reveals indiscretions. They're told of the system we're here. In fear for their lives, they muddle their truth with stories created. But the truth remains the same. Their stories need hearing. Their pain, healing. They could be free to stay. For there is no they. Just us. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Rosie. Next up, we have Conrad Fisher.
Yeah, I would like to start on someone who's dedicated for a tour where Ishmael Habit, and it's called Bad Free Wife. Something like that. The first was called Hera. The phrase was, there is no root of it, Hera. So, and just by close, but close. That's not Hera. Oh, I'm not sure which everyone has that right now here. And the throw the cold to my head and my frozen throat. Good. My head shakes to the mood. That is exactly what good I had told. That was wearing my second wife. As much as in a Spanish short summer, I played in a party event and I was the drummer. But whom would her, if I would have an arrow left for the well, I would chew a well into my head, like we tell. But I don't. Call him a shooter. Either, do I call out? Scooter. So, I'm not aware of that either. Couldn't be honest with, I guess, myself.
Man, I am a Christian, like a Christian, and simple,
but in my exaltation I am free at once from all my sins. I am no longer a single suffering individual. I am one with the folk and God. In such a moment, any doubt about my life and work vanish like the light in it. From Ernst Mode up. And I will just throw that into a room to give it up to you. Your thoughts are free. No one can give them. They flee by like shadows in the night. No man can know them. No hunter can shoot them with powder and lead. Your thoughts are free. Yeah, we almost have to listen. We won't take all the Christmas calls. So, that is the mainly poem I was going to read. It is dedicated to Sophie and Hans Scholl, Christoph Kirsch, Alexander Schmoller, Mr. Kurt Huber, William Graf, Sven Munich, for a cause that is also a cause of all mankind to be human. The truth shall not be forgotten, as you are not forgotten. You will live in soul and memory instead, and then forever. Because you have vanished with the time, but you also made the cloud vanish, the dust, the dark. You fought for sun and enlightenment in our heart. We went to prevent the darkness in times of fear and shame. You've made a claim for humanity to remain, but not in pain. You made it with your free heart, and no one will throw any darts to your head anymore. Yes, that's saving call. So it shall be history, never be the same again. What you've done, Christ-alike, but you are more, because you are not a lie, because you are human in blood and sense, your bravery immense. Oh, my fallen comrades, my love, my beloved ones, please forgive me. I wish to be intense. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Conrad, and for the uncertainty factor. Thank you. There was a Mongolian MC who taught me about the mic, and that it really should be somewhere away from your face, you know? Otherwise it
tends to pop and things like that, you know?
So try and keep a little bit of distance from it in your mouth, if you can.
But thank you very much, that was great. Next up, we haven't seen him in a while, so we welcome Jerry O'Neill.
This is a sort of poem by default, and it was an attempt at writing a song, and I never came up with a melody, but I read it to a number of people at one stage, and they said, ah, sure, we can't leave it as a poem. I think they were being polite, but anyway. It was an attempt to describe a scene a number of years ago during the Cork Folk Festival. And in its place I said art galleries, and there was a bit of music and just a small crowd there, sun shining. And a young girl started to dance spontaneously from the audience, and started seemed to bring the place to life. And it reminded me of some of these old Dutch or Flemish paintings of wedding feasts and coolies of various types. And there's a reference to Joan Denise, who introduced ballet to Ireland, of course. And she thought that dancing in some place there in the place of the West And the box referred to is the bottom accordion. And all our reports or your audience can be dazzling. In traditional music, starts with the bottom accordion and the box. It's a bit sentimental and saccharine, but that was the way I was feeling at the time. Tableau, September 1st, 2002. On a Crawford wall, a rustic scene, peasants dance on a village green. One joyous moment in a rush, chronicled with oil and brush. But through the window, on the square, another tableau displayed there. A little lass and painted face, kicks up her knees with wreaths and grapes. The ghost of Joan Denise sits round, correcting posture with a frown. While Buckley's bow round trembling beat, accompanies the skipping feet, and bongos from some far-off land, exotic rhythms join the band. But over every day like this, sunshine as warm as a lover's kiss, as round the square the honey note of box and concertina float. A crumpled man with bag of cans, and tattered face and shaky hands, halts his journey for a while, then breaks into a toothy smile. A withered child with twisted limb from his wheelchair starts to sing. A gull drifts by a lazy wing to where the fleshy mullets spring. And over every day like this, sunshine as warm as a lover's kiss, as round the square the honey note of box and concertina float. The Farnity is Tim the Brit, who goes along with Danny Wit. Do not be shy, but take a chance. The Siege of Venice is the next dance. Now Tanny sporting sleeky shades with jaunty butter on parade, while Linda clears her throat to sing of murder foul and fair Dublin. And over every day like this, sunshine as warm as a lover's kiss, as round the square the honey note of box and concertina flow. In some dark room, sad men conspire and scheme to set the world on fire, while bloodshed flares on TV screen where bloody corpses mar the scene. But here at least for a short space, there's peace and calm on a place. The lynchers play a sweet slow air, and tunis creeps across the square. And over every day like this, sunshine is warm, as a lover's kiss, as round the square the honey note of box and concertina float. So here's to those who run the show, and may the fela bloom and grow. We'll raise a toast and sing good cheer, that we may meet again next year. We'll dance the plain set, me and you, with Emmett Place the rendezvous. And may the sun weep from above, and drown us all in tears of love. Tomorrow.
Thank you very much, Jerry. And next up, another fine poet, Mr. Graham Allen.
Okay, this one is it's called The One That Got Away, and if I remember, this is after first hearing Matthew Sweeney read in UCC. I think it was it last year? Was it? I don't know, Mary. Was it last year or that? Or? Okay, anyway, it doesn't matter.
This year.
Yeah. First time I heard Matthew. I think this is...
Oh, there is no voice.
She works for the UCC.
All right.
Thank you. The one that got away. The only book he would read was The Time Machine. The only colour he could stand was blue. He boarded up the windows from the inside and learned to find food like a cat in the garden. He collected rainwater and baked bean tins, trained his eyes to negotiate the darkness. Every morning, as regular as clockwork, he made his poetic bid for freedom. He wrote a poem about Blake and eternity. When he flung it in the fire, it curled like a trout. He wrote a ballad about Orion and pin-headed cybox, then tore it into strips and ate it as pasta. He wrote 300 sonnets addressed to his father, each one of them soggy enough to sip. He wrote an epic about Ceres and her seasons. Stuffed into his duvet, it warmed him during winter nights. Finally, he realized the answer had been there, all that long, long time inside of the moon. So he sat on the grass by the rustin deck chairs, inside his overgrown nighttime garden. Joe slowed his eyes to the monthly ebb and flow, construction and ruination of herself, the breathing in and out of her diaphragm. Even kept faith with the fake stony shape she would pin up into the blue of the day, until he had written the most original poem anyone of his kind had ever penned. By the time it was time to reopen doors and windows, his house was a bank with a security system.
I'm going to get Matthew to say that on the MP3. You're fine with that.
Thank you, Graham.
Next up, I think we have, is it Dorothy Begley? Dorothy Begley, to the mic, please.
It's a short story. I looked across the small flat bushes, tops of which were at a level with my eyes, up the slope of the hill towards the northeast, and saw the warm rays of evening sun catching yellow green of the late October grass, and the tinge of crimson in the body of the tall hawthorn tree on the bounds of Campton's field, where on the crest of which the kestrel sat, swaying easily in what breeze there was. There was not a breath of wind where I stood, but the tree swayed up on the hill. It is rare, I think, that one would be in a tempting case to find this colour of late autumn twilight in an Irish field. Some photographers have to try and succeed it, but in painting know what to think of them. I have no eyes, so not for me to try to find light in a palace, and indeed I have no patience for going out looking for light, mixing colours, learning what oils, learning what forms and depths. Van Gogh in Auvergne, after all his life of toil and thought, going about the fields, painting two paintings a day, a landscape in the morning and a portrait in the evening, or two landscapes on a good day, two portraits on bad, and the owners of the hospital teaching him a poor miserable food, a burden and not worth knowing, or worth charging money for what misery he was getting from them. And their heirs now looking for 10 euros from a person to feed his room, putting out in a field for money so they can buy one of his paintings. Sickened by the feeling and by the thought, I turned back to the work. The drain was pure black with age old muck. I was well stuck, and there I was stuck in it, trying to shovel and drag a tear of the dike up out of the bank. And for what? Some sense of duty to my old mother. To be fair to her, she digged this muck all day and asked nothing better. Baron gave us a chance to do it between licking the cows and cooking the dinner. She was a powerful woman to work. Where have I ever gotten her? Nowhere. Down up to her knees in a black dike, shoveling black shit up onto the side, building the shit up around her like turf to her, only it wasn't turf but sodden muck. Down at the end of this drain, I once saw a little eagle stabbing, though we are 50 miles from the sea, and as white with little yellow feet, enough of food and a flew off to the southwest towards where I landed. When we got again, the light was duller now, the moment of radiance gone, the chest was gone with it. I thought about the time of day, and I didn't need to look to know if there weren't really any other decent being called dreams about, none that high anyway, and I thought that I might come this way with the door in a couple of days' time. By then the tree and the smaller hawthorn trees in the side of it would be like a red wall. The sky was pallid with day, but to look down into the black light would see the night tree figure. I climbed up out of the dike and walked on my knees over the field, up the yard to the shed, and left in shovel and drag. For those of you who don't know, the drag around here anyway is a four-pronged pipe with long prongs folded over like a saw, with a handle of around 10 feet and then used for pulling debris and muck out of sight, dragging them. A very useful instrument in an area like this, where life is spent trying to keep sight clear and forlorn hope that the fields will drain someday. It didn't rain all summer like this summer just gone and the one before, and you have to throw your hat at it. But still there I was, dragging the dike. The evening crept ahead of me. I brought in a wall of timber, putting the wheat back beside the fire. A gawar, for those who don't know, is an armful of anything, although we couldn't use it only for timber. Maybe because hay, which is the only other thing I could think of, though I might carry off in an armful, can be measured by bales and fraction of bales. And I stood in front of the fire, warming myself for a bit until it would get dark, properly dark. The long nights of winter have been ill at ease, sitting at home with the old folk, watching Ryan Tubridge or Winnie Street or Law and Order. I went out to feed the dog, out in the engine room. My mother had left the straps from her day at the hotel, three white buckets of stock. The sale of salad mustn't have been great today, because each bucket was to be full of stock. There's no way the dogs are going to eat three bucks of potato salad. The best potato salad at that, they kill them. What was that do with the other two buckets? But the hens didn't eat what we were talking about. And we certainly weren't going to eat it. So I took two buckets of it and stacked it out over towards Moriarty. We were putting it in. I took the two buckets and moved out, it up towards the near field to a spot where it was shallow enough to cross over easy. As I was coming out the engine room door, I saw the ghost again, standing above by the garage, the same as the time before. I looked up to see what way the moon was, because the last two times I'd noticed that it was an exact half moon that had been there. But no, this time the moon had waned well past the halfway stage. It was almost new, and I knew this already. Why else do you think I felt draining dike, only that it was a well-waned moon? And therefore, it was far too early in the evening for the moon to have come far yet. The ghost must have unsettled me more than I thought. I could not figure out what his sequence must be. So far, the boy had said nothing to me. I just stood there, all white and silent, looking at me. This was the first time since last winter, so maybe that was important. I took note again of time and day, waited for a minute to see if he'd say anything this time. Well, if he's anything to say, he'd say it. And I was freezing, waiting to say anything at all. So I headed away and left him where he was. I hadn't gone over the river, just besides spot a couple of weeks. So it gave me all I could do to get over without being drenched in the way, especially with two full buckets. I was coming in at Moriarty's now, in the back way, through their old potato field, so I had to go easy. The dogs knew me well enough, so I stood a while to let them know I was there, to let them know it was me before I went any closer. They pushed on up the field, keeping in by the ditch. At the gate, I could see in the window of the house. You could see Jane Moriarty making tea while watching the telly in the kitchen. Quickly come down to the BBC. The sitting room curtain was drawn, but I knew old Jerome Moriarty was there, staring at the fire, muttering to himself. I tipped the contents of one of the buckets onto one post to the gate, the contents of the other bucket onto the other post. Then I walked back the way I had come, with the empty bucket as far as the river, where I turned upstream before I stopped, thinking of my car over from the road and took the scene. I came to their house and back as well. The curtains were drawn, so there were three lights lit, one of them in an end room. I stood on the far side of the ditch in their lawn, looking up at her window. By the time I moved again, the moon was risen over the mountain. I got home by midnight. I had a yard brush in my hand, but I could not for the life of me remember where I picked it up. Not Moriarty and not Moroni, but there would hardly be a yard book out in the field, so I didn't really know where I got from. I put it away in the old cowhouse. I must have left them down somewhere. The next morning, Sunday morning, I was up early, so I looked to stand abroad and hear the bells coming up from by the land at half a day, and from Galilee at 9, and by the land again at half 9, 9 before at 10, Galilee at half 6, by the land at 11, finally the angels were once more at half 11. I see the people in the cars going up and down the road, some of them leisurely, and looking forward to the chat before Mac. Some are in a hurry, Harris even their prayers, cursing themselves to their drive for their habitual lady. I saw Mary Hogan's wreck yesterday going down to cross Mac long before the bell had rung and gone slow. Mrs. Moriarty was at Galilee at 9, two were only to the land at half 9. Mr. Moriarty was at Anglesborough at 10, and Pat Hogan was the last match at Anglesborough at half 11, and stood up in the gallery with many of his cards the night before. The Angelus rang as I was rounding the hill towards a little wood on the edge of 16. That I have seen grow from 10 foot to 30 in my time. I love the angel of sales best of all, the way that one would start in another joined in another, and they would beat their separate rhythm, each one unaware of the soul of the other, but that those separate and unknowing units would meet and merge and create something new, and new each time, so their rhythms would change ever so slightly, but also their apartness was never the same each time, so their union never the same. If the air were cold or dry or heavier, their souls and sounds would meet differently, and more than this, I knew that another, listening to the three bells at the same moment, a mile in one direction or another, even a few feet away, would not hear them as I heard them. But would maybe hear Galilee that much clearer or less distinctly, or would have they landed me his or her ears that much sooner, perhaps speaking at precisely the same moment as the angles were available for a few weeks at least, then the wind would change, and the contours would change in shape, and you have to strain again to hear how the bells called out, calling with each other without being aware of each other's thoughts. And my listening, and that is one known other a mile down the river or up higher towards Angleborough, or just on the other side of the ditch from me, was like the sounding of bells, and our training was like waves in the air, meeting, reflecting, with constructive and destructive interference, resonance, refraction, even Doppler effects as I move or the other listener moves. But none of us ever to know as insensate as the bells. The sounds would be dying away by the time I got to the top of Elder Ash and Oak, the Oak still young, the Ash now striving to its full age, the Elder age. I came here every Sunday after the bells had done, because it was here that I once saw the heart of Christ in the park of Nash Street, brown red and moving blood down into the street. I never saw it again, but that was 10 years ago, but still I used to come here on Sunday. I think some people must know they're from there. There's never any wind here, except on one side by the front of the hill and on the other by the trees. I fell down on my knees and dried my hands. I looked up and prayed that we might all be forgiven. Samson to Holmes and the Moriarty to Moroni, my parents to White Lion myself, and all of us all around between the two churches and north side of the mountain might be spared again.
Razor on the dead sickening fruit of the lost time, and lay no charge to what she has brought. The crown of ups and downs rests in her lap, and her heart will witness things seen and not before seen, and carry on as before. For now Razor drinks to the dead and living, and the absent who cannot find direction, hope, or sunlight. For we are blind and cannot feel the thing of charm and desert. This one is called Mania. Don't get up, don't rest, and smile and smile and smile yourself to insanity, to the height of gods and alertness. Slaughter and shape your blood to beauty, and craft conversation to your own pace. Writing in silliness and wit, crash into 100 yards, shards of glory and folklore, and hold a candle to your equals, if only to burn yourself. They never stop to rest, to think, to call a halt to thundering events. For all this will fall center, like a cheap mantle cock that affords its age. Thanks.
Thank you, Patricia. And next up, could we please welcome Mr. Eugene O'Connell.
And district day, which are also real as they are. There were in the 19th century, the Anglo-Irish and the landlords used to build these things. They were collies, and they had absolutely no purpose at all. And there's still an awful lot of them in the other areas. But anyway, this poem of mine is actually about a thing that light has probably kind of a little round tower, and every day at the time my father was a builder and I was growing up in all this when I was young, and every day when he was tagging on the road on the mallow to climb the road, we used past this building to kind of a round tower. And the idea of it was, it was actually built in the 1940s, I think, 20s, because it was an early version of the silos for silage. And I think it came from Australia originally, so the door at the bottom. You know, the poetic thing, it's kind of a charge to be folly. The folly of what seems I passed every day as a child had a reason. Not like the follies of the gates of the nearby estates in Castlebagna. There was a door at the bottom that would put a horse through, to walk round and trample the grass, the wind piped in from the top, so that when the silo filled up to the brim, the horse could walk out onto the bank. But what if the weather broke? The question was always on my lips as I passed. Of the men who were called away, would a horse be condemned forever to walk around this concrete tomb?
Thank you, Eugene. Next up we have the Samoa Harriet.
There were some references earlier in the book launch to Granada and the Alhambra and so on, so I thought I'd read a half-true story about a bizarre evening in the gypsy caves above Granada. It's called Am I Getting Away With It? He looked Irish. His mannerisms were Irish, his attitude was Irish. Even the way he was trying to get the crack going and get the girls to laugh during their flamenco dance performances. The little group of Irish tourists in the gypsy caves above Granada, in Sacramento, in above Granada, all agreed he must be Irish. Up to now he had been merely beating out a rhythm on the box he was sitting on, accompanying the guitars and the dramatic singing and dancing on the little makeshift stage. Now, he was up dancing, and it was a truly awful representation of the ancient art, a sort of soft shoe shuffle. He was even wearing the wrong shoes with no raised heel, perhaps with a hint of something he had seen in the Connemara Gaelic thrown in, and the occasional, vaguely flamenco gesture. The Japanese tourists nearby accepted it all without a murmur, but were puzzled at the barely stifled mirth of the Irish tourist, who had christened this character Seamus. At the end of his strange dance, Seamus looked out at the audience, gave a most un-Spanish nod of thanks, and his face wore one of those, am I getting away with this expression? But he kept a straight face when an Irish voice called out, fair play to you, Seamus, as he was passing back down between the audience at the interval. Either we were wrong about him, the tourist said, or else he was not only a chancer, but a chancer with a past. The speculation then began that Seamus had been teaching English in Granada, had been hanging around the gypsy taverns, had got the gorgeous flamenco dancer pregnant, and had been forced to marry her at knife point by her parents. That might have been the mama up there on stage, the hard-faced older woman looking on sternly at his antics on stage. It also became apparent why the big group of tourists had been led all around the old Moorish Albaycin quarter by the Moroccan guide, who said his ancestors had been expelled from there. This detour took place for an hour and a half in an icy wind off the snow-clad Sierra Nevada, instead of the tourists being taken straight to the flamenco show they had paid for. The guide had been on the mobile phone ever so often to check whether to bring them to the venue yet. Probably an extra show had been slotted in before the scheduled one, and this might have been the cause of the delay. So, had the male dancers walked off in protest at too much extra work, and had Seamus been drafted in instead? He certainly seemed to have enough of a brass neck to say he could do it, no problemo. The other thing that tended to confirm the speculation was that the mama, possibly the mother-in-law of Seamus, had also decided to give it a whirl. Perhaps she herself was replacing a younger female dancer who may also have walked off in protest. Now, the mama was no spring chicken. While she'd been sitting up there on the platform, it was apparent that she had been keeping a glinting eagle eye on the bar trade, mentally topping up the evening's takings. But after a slow head start, it is quite possible she hadn't danced for a number of years, she got into the swing of the thing and was soon obviously enjoying her performance on the stage. What happened next confirmed suspicions about Seamus. He produced a bottle of Fundador brandy from the back of the box he was sitting on, uncapped it and proceeded to sweep from it. Then he proffered the bottle to the stunning looking gypsy girl beside him. She swore at him and belted him across the face. The bottle went flying, scattering the brandy all over the stage. The mama leapt on Seamus, tearing at his face in fury. The corpulent singer broke off in the middle of his singing and strode across to sort out the situation. Halfway across, he skidded on the spilled brandy. His feet went from under him and he crashed down on the stage. There was a loud cracking sound and the whole platform disintegrated, pitching the flamenco troupe higgledy-piggledy into the laps of the front row in the audience. Amid the shrieks of consternation and laughter, Seamus rose from the debris, waving another bottle of brandy, and yelled out in the adenoidal tones of proletarian Dublin, "Jesus, folks, talk about going out with a bang!"
Thank you, Niall. Thank you very much. Next up we have, how would you read this? Recently elected poet laureate of Cork, Mr. Jerry Bartlett.
After the recent election, with its paltry turnout and appalling result, the government declared that the people had finally forfeited its confidence, so it dissolved them and formed them up. I don't know if you've seen these, donation boxes in shops. This is just about a particular donation box. I asked a particular question, and this is the answer I got. It's called appeal. "Which earthquake?" I inquire of the shopkeeper, pointing at the donation box. "I'm not sure," he replies. "Probably the most recent, or maybe the one before that." Some fucking earthquake.
Thanks, Jerry. And next up we have Mr. Seamus Harrington.
Thanks, Jerry. The word is, he's back from Glencar. They'll coax him tonight in the bar. Relate that tall tale, when you hoist the sail, to fight for your uncle, the Tsar. You are here. The mess room falls away astern. He juggles papers in a rush, bounding up the companionway, keeping to the navigable channel on the right. Lights and shapes are revisited, the class work groups huddled over almanacs and symbols, parallel rulers and dividers wink at the ready. Handouts with celestial navigation make a transit of the chart room. Now before we get our bearings, scuffle. One of the hands has hit the deck, fainted. A blip of pulse, polar face, no inclination to take a sip of liquid. He's shipped out by his mate. 997, falling slowly. At 14:13 on Midsummer's Day, we undertake the tricky crossing of the busy sea corridor at MNCI. Visibility, good. The card is white. We spring through double doors to B block, the third waypoint. Then leaving the fountain to port, we head straight on. The sick bay lies due west. Conditions moderating. Survivors mustered at his desk, pint in horror, adrift in the foggy flotsam of dog-eared Admiralty charts, cables of magnetic variation, instruments of exactitude, listless angles of declination, a page from the lost logbook of Christopher Columbus.
Hey.
And this is 2 weeks late. I couldn't find it 2 weeks ago. Jamming. Snare drums rattling, trombone zoom, tenor sax screaming, double bass boom, guitars twanging from electric heights, chimes still tinkle to muted lights, silver flutes tootle, percussions brush, clarinets warble to alto sax gush, trumpet calling, tambourines jing, hi-hat lifting to cowbells ring, the sirens blare, notes so shrill, harmonicas bleat to whistles trill, banjo's rat-a-tat will curtly reply to conch shell echo of piccolo high, xylophones hit, but tubas rude, bongo's rhythm get in the mood, keyboards persisting, notes so brash, French horns burping, cymbals crash, oboes blending as fiddles in sync, give jiving cats no time to think. Baby, that's jazz.
Yeah, it's pretty great to join there. Isn't there that round at the bar there? I thought it was like, but there's like James Liberty. There weren't really, but coincidentally, it happens to be that round time.
Could you come on just a little bit more?
Sorry, if anyone wants to play, please. That's the one. Next up we have Mr. Peter Lucy.
Tomorrow is the anniversary of the end of World War I, as mine was assuming. So I thought I'd just write a poem called Anthem for Doom Youth, a very famous poem by Wilfred Owen, a man who fought and died in World War I. So, Anthem for Doom Youth. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns. Only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty arsons. No mockeries now for them, no prayers nor bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells. And bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all, not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes shall shine the holy glimmer of goodbyes. The pallor of girls, brows shall be their pall. Their flowers, the tenderness of silent minds, and each so doth the drawing down of blinds. That's it. And I got that slightly wrong on the stage, so I thought I'd say that it's a very, very good poem, so I didn't want to mess up. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Next up we have Mr. Dorr Hardy.
The haiku called Clap. Keep going, Clap. Keep going.
I've all got the claps, all right.
Keep going, Clap. I caught it one time at 17 in Crab Lane, I think. There were lines in his face. The ripples and from receded when the tide began, but the inkling of the storm lit his grey eyes. The haggard crag in his cheeks cooled his inner thought, like a flummox of hope or move a train with a keeping push. He could sniffle a story a mile away, bank it for future reference with great interest and no account, and to no account. His ears were like a hare's antennae, sensing the form of the unsuspecting and the unruffled. He scented their secret philosophy. Let your inspiration be others, he said. Wear their feathers. But you call the devil glad. Thanks, Matt Lappin.
Say nothing. It's awfully clever, really.
That's when you both did, isn't
it? Very nice.
Called the devil's glad to vote. But I grew up with to end up and as a wine on the street. I went desperate slowly through the glass with steady hand into Villeneuve. I went desperate slowly through the glass with steady hand took it to my lips. The devil's glad that moment came to pass. The gates of hell invited me to cross and welcome me in my triple trip. I went desperate slowly through the glass. There was a cloud before my dreams to toss aside, but I ignore that cloud's tip. The devil's glad his moment came to pass. Now I am in the grip and feel no loss, and I savour all the dripping drips. I went desperate slowly through the glass. My boat is swirling round under duress. No light shines from other passing ships. The devil's glad my moment came to pass. The time has gone for me to come to grips, except the time has gone for me to come to grips, except for the glass that never slips. I went desperate slowly through the glass. The devil's glad our moment came to pass.
Thanks, Laura. Next up we have, I think the first time, Mr. Tomas Afiechon.
Hoi, it's just a short little poem I wrote one day when walking the dog. It's called Some Balls. You must take some balls to be a man and wear fake tan. You casually have chandeliers swinging from your ears while standing aside a mountaintop proclaiming to the world, fuck off, and salad.
Next up to the open mic, could we please have Hara Abdullah.
I wrote this poem thinking about the Orient, so... The flowers in my fingers bloom, bluebells, violets, lilacs, blue, tops in the middle of the room, the grinder of magician's heart, sharply against the sea. The youthful bullies of my young girl, the summer wind, the ocean warmth, the depth, the cold, the humid stream, the extreme, linger and decay the tree, its body blades. First back warm shines like the sun, its mighty stallion and drum. My gallop essence is combined with glasses of expensive wine. In cheap caverns near drifty rivers, pretentious drunks consume their livers, while mighty arms eat full carts of men with liquored veins and empty hearts.